Yeah, so as the walk-in slide, I have put up an underwater video of one of our experimental currents, one of our experimental turbidity currents. And for scale, there's a lot of foreshortening in this camera view. So the inlet we can see on the top there is about 5 meters away from the camera. There's a slope, a gently exiting canyon mouth equivalent, and the turbidity current makes its way down the slope. These are velocity probes here, which are quite close to the camera, so they are only spaced 20 centimeters apart in lateral view, and we'll get to see plenty of velocity data from those probes. And we can see the large current as it inflates when it comes down the slope, and then it engulfs the underwater camera, and we disappear into what we call the head of the current behind the front. And then there's the neck, we stick to the body analogy. And there we have the body, so the main phase, the kind of quasi-steady or continuing phase of the current coming down the slope, which is actually much thinner than the front and the head of the current.
What is the material yours?
Okay, that's a good question. It's sand, mostly. So the cloud we can see at the top, that's silt, so that will be 30 to 60 microns typically in this experiment, but the main part of the flow, the sediment in there, so 75% of the sediment is sand with a median grain size of 150 microns. And the D90 is close to 300 typically, or 250, something like that. So there's some of my collaborators and students in Utrecht and previous sponsors, as well as two new sponsors that have come on board this year. So my title was Single Grains, Dense Suspensions, and Dispersed Grain Size Distributions, but in our new regime of sticking to an hour and a half of speaking time, I'm putting the last subject between brackets, and it's going to have to wait until sometime later in the program when I'm a bit further with the analysis of that as well. So what I'll do firstly is illustrate what my perspective as a geologist to these phenomena and the problems that they give me is, and I'll do it by using this case that Eckhart introduced to us last week. We're there on the little tip where it says Isla Vista on the campus, and the strange circle here with the photo icon. That's where the drilling platform is, or the production platform is, that we can see offshore to the west. And just beyond that, we see in the seascape image, so this is a bathymetric image, which has been, I'm not sure whether the data source is on here. Yeah, it's been obtained by the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, located a bit north of here. And we can see this really large structure where the slope steepens, in the landscape, where a large mass of the seafloor has become unstable and has slid into the Santa Barbara Channel. And we had a bit of a sparring session last week, what kind of event that could have been that created that deposit. And we have very similar problems when we go look at the rock records. So what this is a deposit created about 120 million years ago in an era that we call the Aptian. This is located in the south of France, this outcrop location. For those of you who are into cycling, when the Tour de France went to the Mont Ventoux this year, they drove past this outcrop on the Mont Ventoux stage. So that's the kind of place you get to study these deposits. And what it is a hillside, which provides us a cross-section. The deposit was formed in the Cretaceous on the slope going into an ocean, which was then in the location where now the Mediterranean Sea is. But that was not the Mediterranean Sea, because that entire ocean was crushed between Italy and Europe as Italy moved into Europe to create what we now know as the European Alps. So this was the ocean that existed north of the Alps before the Alps existed. And at the base of that slope, we find this region where we have deposits, which we call mass transport deposits. And there are two here labeled E and H in this cross section. And if we zoom in on those rocks, we see that they consist of very large blocks with discontinuities between them, but with internally coherent stratifications. And in some places, such as we see in the zoom up here, we see that those blocks are completely deformed and folded and kind of squeezed and slid over each other.
So you're saying this is not due to the formation of the Alps?
No.
And
the structural geologists, my good colleagues, they have done 150 years of alpine geological research, and they know precisely the folds and the faults in the alpine structures, what their orientations are with respect to the direction with which Italy was pushed into Europe. And they can quite easily say that this is not related to that. And they will also look at things like the mineralizations on the plains in between these blocks or the microstructures in this folding. And they will tell you that this is not a structural folding related to plate tectonics.
Is there also a distinction in scales between the tectonic structures and those structures that you show us, that those are much smaller scale maybe than... it's not as simple as that.
I would say that... these have a more definite scale associated with them. This is a typical scale. Whereas if you look at structural deformation, it's typically expressed, so the same deformation is expressed over all scales, from micro scales, okay, scales of crystals, okay, all the way up to the entire Alps itself.
Okay, so you're saying that the tectonic structures have a strong scale invariance?
Yes.
What do you say?
Yeah. Okay. And they display coherent deformations over all those scales that belong.
Interesting.
Yeah. So zooming in onto what's between those mass transport processes, and this is typically a deposit that I associate with that Santa Barbara Channel example. So zooming into there, we can see the backpack of my student who has courageously made his way up that slope, which is no mean feat. And he went up to that sand body there because that's eventually what we are really aiming for. And he looked at the relation between the internal sedimentary structures in the sand body and the topography and the irregularity of that mass transport deposit. And we find that the sandstone is really nicely horizontally onlapping onto that topography. And we interpret that to mean that topography existed first as a rugosity on the seafloor, and the turbidity current just deposited its sand in flat horizontal orientation onto that topography. And what we end up with is an integration of all the modern setting and outcrop models that lead us to a coherent model of what the morphology of these mass transport events look like, how their deposits are expressed, how the deformation is associated with rugosity on the seafloor. And we can see here, it's not quite clear, but we can see here these structures in the mass transport example here in the Santa Barbara Channel are analogous to these these structures related to the stopping, the compression at the end of the movement of the event when it actually decelerates.
What is MTB?
Sorry?
What is MTB?
Oh yeah, sorry, that's our term for mass transport deposit. So a deposit that was formed by a process in which the mass became unstable, started to slide, and it could disintegrate and internally deform, but it did not entrain water to the point where it became a dilute turbidity current. So it's everything but turbidity currents.
Like a debris flow?
Yes, yeah, that will be the mobile end of the spectrum of mass transport deposits. And on the other side, you have just the seafloor just slides down a little bit. That will be the very immobile end of that spectrum.
As an aside, I think in your picture of the seafloor there, to the left of those big slides, there are also some of these gullies that we talked about last week. And that's a nice picture with some regular
here.
Spacing there.
Yeah. I think you're right. And also, if you go slightly out of this view, you can see that there is a crack which has opened on the location where I'm going to speculate that the original failure was, which is around here. So if you follow this line, there's actually a crack here where you can see that there's been a partial failure and the block is just kind of stuck there. And that crack can go on. Yeah.
Do those transverse features indicate that the flow occurred in an interrupted or just continuous way? Or?
These ones, not really. You get a few, they are related. So there's been extension in this realm, and then this is all compressed. So, and that's the way that often happens, people think, and we'll see that actually as well, is that they stop at the front, and then you get this kind of train wreck effect of this compressional regime building back up slope again.
Are you going to explain the difference between fold and thrust ridges on one side and pressure ridges?
Yeah, it's a small nuance. It's into the minutiae, but there's a discontinuity here, whilst if you follow a line here, you could actually have follow it continuously.
In yours, can you see the difference between a pressure ridge and a fold? Thrust ridge in the Santa Barbara?
In this data, yeah. No. On better data quality, yes. Yeah. But this is not the best data that Ambari has on the. It's not the best resolution, and there's especially in industry, there's better data available where you can see the difference. But I mean, it's a striking. This model was made without Bull at all. No. Probably looking at this and these similarities to me are striking. For instance, these big blocks that are stranded here on the top, these kind of failures that didn't really make it, and they're precisely these kind of things that are drawn in the schematic, in the conceptual model there. So decades of looking at these kind of things goes into that, and our work was related to, okay, what is this? What causes the heterogeneity and the scale of heterogeneity in those sandstone deposits that are deposited over the top of that? And that works quite well, but to me it's always very static. So we have a static modern environment and we have a static rock record. I think the rock record is probably the most, it's been like that there for 120 million years and hardly anything has changed with it. So how am I going to go into the field and then interpret the process and the dynamics and everything that has gone on in there? And for me, there's an additional approach, which is to actually do experiments. And this is a top view of an underwater surface, where when I showed this to a conference, and I said, people, well, this could be a seafloor image of an MTD. And we looked at all the features that were in here and the extensional regime and actually the compressional regime here with all these compression structures. And they all agreed with me. And if it were the seafloor, then you would perhaps expect that to be a 5 kilometers, like in the Santa Barbara Channel example. If you look at the entire picture, we can actually see the beam of our flume coming in. And in this picture, we can actually see the true scale of the experiment, looking through the flume, and there's the stairs and our cement mixer in the background. So the morphology of that will fool a geologist. If you sell that as a seafloor image, they will believe it. So that does point to some similarity. You can express these things over certain scales. But if you have an ocean, then you will express it at the scale of that ocean. And if you have a flume, then you will express it at the scale of your flume. So there is some, that's the scaling part of that. So this is actually a movie from the experiment, or a still taken from the movie of the experiment. So we can see looking towards a slope with something that could be a drowned shelf in a high sea level setting, such as we have at the present geological time. That's the reflection here of the top. This is the water surface, so we see a reflection of the top coming in. But I think it's cut out in the movie. Is it playing? It's playing. So what triggers these kind of events? Well, an earthquake, for instance. We can even hear the sound of it. So we saw the waves of the surface reflection. So an earthquake triggers the failure. And once the failure is there, gravity takes over, and it just starts to slide down. And this is quite a sluggish failure, where we can see a lot of these thrust structures. And the material stays quite coherent, and it's just slid over the top, over the back of the
The water itself is not cooling.
Sorry?
The water is not
stagnant. Cooling. Absolutely stagnant. Yeah. This is the next day. So another big earthquake hits California. And that's what will happen in the Santa Barbara Channel, perhaps. So what we see now, actually, you see some hydroplaning. So we see some blocks taking off here as well, which go much quicker. They come from higher on the slope, and they go much quicker. And also here in this region, we start to see that we are losing coherency. That's not because of the screen resolution. That's actually what happened. So that mass really disintegrated.
What is the tidal slope?
In the experiment, we can get it to move on any slope. But if we have it very slope, then it won't really go anywhere. So this was between 15 and 20 degrees, gives the best experimental results. But if you make it, it's quite steep, but it's also, it's not, that doesn't really worry me. If you make this experiment larger, you'll be able to create the same morphology with a gentler slope.
What's the estimated slope in the Santa Barbara Channel?
I'm going to guess at like 3 degrees would be the median of my guess probability distribution.
The sediment here is sand,
yeah? No, that's not sand.
Well,
this is actually cohesive, yeah. And that's the key to the for me to get either a turbidity current where you have a lot of sand, or where you have a lot of cohesion in the sediment. And if the original failure is very cohesive, you'll tend to create these types of.
You mentioned the cement mix earlier now, so is this prepared in that mix?
No, this was actually prepared by having a homogeneous suspension of clay and silt in the water and having it settle down onto the slope.
Did you compact it in any way, or?
No, we just let it stand for 2 weeks.
So it was just the entire hill is made of this?
No,
it's a.
Yeah.
Shape.
Yeah, there is a discontinuity.
So there's a thickness of some layer, which is
precisely. There's a discontinuity in the composition. So the slope itself is actually made of sand, and it's got a cohesive cover.
So you've deposited sand, and then you've let this clay or cement sediment on top.
Yeah.
And can you say more about the triggering?
Yeah, it's very specifically related to that first part, how we deposited the sand. We deposited the sand from suspension, so that the packing of it is not its optimal packing. So that if the earthquake hits, it will compact slightly, which means it needs to expulse its pore water fluid. But it can't because there's a layer of cohesive clay on top. And that creates a zone with very high pore water pressures just beneath that clay, which has a zero strength effectually, and gravity is then able to just pull it down.
The topic that always comes up is whether the release is like a slab avalanche, where an entire flake is released at once, or whether it is very progressive.
These are.
It seemed to me like it was both here.
A retrogressive slab avalanche, could live with that.
Is that something that you observe often, typically, or is
no, because this is really nice for mass transport simulation, but for turbidity currents, we never model it holistically like this, so including the triggering. This holistic type of approach for me it's really nice for mass transport deposits, which these are. So you start with the seafloor, you trigger an event, and you watch its entire evolution. But for turbidity currents, we always say, let there be a turbidity current. And then we see what happens with the downflow part of that initiation.
You change the color, you might be able to convince people it's part of a slab avalanche. It would be interesting.
Can we already see the sand? Or is the layer that?
Yeah, that's the sand. Yeah.
I noticed that in reality, avalanches in snow. You have mud over sand.
It's not like
you know, what you see in shallow is a clinophore.
It's a clinophore.
Clinophore. So I see that's exactly what you did. You have a slope that's concave down.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. There's a bigger story to that experiment, but I'm not going to tell it now because this was my introduction. So that was just by means of illustration of what my research world looks like. We have the modern environment, which is a source of great research, but mostly inspiration for me. We have the static rock record with deposit examples of things that are not accessible in the ocean or in the subsurface where oil companies are exploring for the sandstones. We do physical experiments to get a grip or some illustration of the processes involved. And then there's numerical experimentation as well, of course. And that's not a numerical experiment of one of these things, but that's a numerical experiment of a turbidity current that I will address later on in my talk. So there's all this interdisciplinary landscape. And if I define what I do myself, then I'm a geologist who does experiments. That's my position in there. And my problem most certainly comes from the rocks, from the deposits. So this is a cross-section of a turbidite. This is a turbidite. It's a very complex turbidite, but we're not going to talk about that too long, I hope. And the problem that geologists have is that this is the typical amount of rock that they are allowed to work with, that much. So that's the diameter of their well. And they're only allowed to work with it in this way, so actually to touch the rock if their management has approved spending $40 million for 100 foot of core being brought up. So that's very, very rare these days for companies to still take core out of these deep water wells, because it's an amazing engineering problem. I'm always hugely impressed that they do this, taking these rocks up from designated spots and intervals at 4 or 5 kilometers depth, sometimes at 1500 meters of water depth. So they've got this much rock to work with, and their task is to actually predict the rock characteristics away from the well. So what are the characteristics of these deposits as you go either upslope, downslope, or laterally? And you have to do that for kilometer scales. So what are these deposits and what's going to happen with them? How much can you predict? And especially when if you take the inverse of that question, the question is mostly, can you get a grip on the uncertainties? So what are the uncertainties involved? Not necessarily what is the right answer, but what is the suite of possibilities that we have. And the way in which we boldly market our research with the people who fund us is that if we can understand the processes that form these deposits and we know how they evolve down the slope, then we can make a more reasoned prediction or a more closely argued region of possibilities of what is actually there in the environment of the wells. I think that was the introduction of where I'm coming from and what my problems are. And the first part of the where we actually look at some data, I wanted to I put in after last week, where I realized that I was asking a lot of questions of, yeah, but how large is that grain, or what does that Stokes number mean? And the reason why I ask those questions is that this is my data. So this is a turbidite deposit, and we can see the grains that are in there. This is from Italy, from Tuscany on the coast. And these are quartz grains, the white ones. And we can see that they spread a wide range of scales. And the smaller grains, we can't see the shape. But the quartz grains, the large ones, are illustrative. If you put this under the microscope, then there are no spheres in there. So we have irregular grains, and they are distributed from micron size to, in this picture or just next to it, the largest one I measured was 8 millimeters. So we have a broad range of grains and grain shapes. And I'm interested in learning from everybody's presentation how what they're showing me is related to this parameter range.
How much distance this would have traveled? Kilometers?
This one, depending on whether you believe whether it came from Corsica or from the Alps, 20 or 200 kilometers.
Definitely tens of kilometers,
yes.
Hundreds of
kilometers. Yeah, yeah. So this is coarse, yeah?
8 millimeter particle.
Will have gone that distance, okay. Yeah. It's not necessarily like that in all systems. If people say, look how big my turbidity current system is, it's 1,000 kilometers long, then these grains won't have made it to the end of that system. They will have been deposited more proximally.
You said that this was formed then when Corsica already was there, so this is more recent than that.
Well, it's more that before Corsica started moving away into the Mediterranean, but yeah, it was that massive. What those granites of Corsica would be the source of these quartz grains. Yeah.
So this was underwater.
Yes.
Is this a deposition from one single turbidity current?
This is deposition from one single turbidity.
What is the low height?
This one is 50 centimeters thick. But it can be this type of facies or rock can be anything from this much to a few meters.
So there's no visible grading at all?
No.
And is that common or is that unusual?
It's very common. Yeah, for the main part of the deposit, for there to be very little grading, is very common. And also the sorting is appalling. Yeah, there is no sorting of the grains in this main division.
So what's the difference between grading and sorting?
The grading is the size, and the sorting is the standard deviation of the grain size distribution. So what we would say, it's poorly sorted. It has a very large standard deviation of grain size. Yeah.
But you do get a grading in the flow direction.
Right? Yeah, and also at the top of the events. Yeah. So with that in mind, I wanted to. This is a single grain that I'm settling in in a tube of light in a dark room with light coming from the top. So it's just a quartz grain taken from a river. And I've done some poor man's particle tracking analysis this time, because this is just taken with a normal Canon camera with a fish bowl and a rubber sheet. So it's this very simple, very cheap experiment. And we get these values for the settling velocity, but also for the Stokes number. I've used that expression. I'm not sure whether it's the same as the time scales that everybody's been using, but I think this is more the momentum and viscous scale. I'm not sure. It's the force scales, I think. Is that the same as the time scales ratio? Can anybody? I mean, we've seen a lot of Stokes time scales, but this is.
I mean, this fluid is at rest, so there's essentially no fluid time scale.
Right. Yeah. Apart from perhaps the wake behind it, but not evidently so. No. I mean, this is the Stokes scale that I encounter a lot when I look at people's papers talking about sediment grains in fluids. It's a different Stokes number from the one that has predominantly been used last week. So that's why I make sure I put the.
So what's the meaning of Stokes number? Typically, when we talk about Stokes number, we are talking about time it takes for particles to adjust to the flow,
yeah,
versus the time scale on which the flow is changing.
Yeah, I knew I was going to be in trouble last week when I realized that this Stokes number is a different Stokes number from those. That time scale Stokes number that you're talking
about.
But is it the same?
It's
the same Stokes, and this is just a different community using his name for another non-dimensional number. Mm-hmm. And
it's like Stokes drag. Kind of
that's right. It's the ratio between the viscous, if I'm going to phrase this rightly, viscous drag and the momentum in some shape, so velocity times mass.
It should just be a function of the particle Reynolds number.
Yeah.
I think so, which is why I've put the particle Reynolds number beneath it for people who are more familiar with that value. But I think through all the slides, those two are going to change in a linear relation. So it's the reason I have persisted in putting it up there, despite knowing I was going to be in trouble, is the figure that will appear in 4 or 5 slides' time. So please bear with me until that time.
I think they're essentially exactly the same, because
yeah,
you can write the mass as density times radius to the
yeah,
third
yeah,
power.
Yeah.
I think so, but the Stokes number allows me to relate this to a different part of the literature, yeah, which I'll do in 5 slides' time.
That's a Greek letter nu in the denominator.
That's right. It's the kinematic viscosity, but it's a poor font type.
Yeah,
so it hardly shows. Sorry about that. Yeah. Yeah, I apologize for the poor nu in Calibri, I think.
What do you mean by time to rest?
Ah, that's a good point. So this is the velocity, the settling velocity, and in blue is the one on the vertical axis. And then green is a lateral velocity. And the time to rest is the time interval it takes from this moment when the velocity starts to drop off, or this moment when we see a very distinct break in the lateral velocity, to the moment when the grain has stopped moving fully. And the data frequency is 60 hertz, so 5 seconds, that would typically be 3 to 4 frames.
That's essentially when the particle is very close to the bottom boundary.
Yes.
So that time has something to do with the lubrication theory of particles.
Yeah. I'm sure it has, but we are already on quite a high value for that Stokes number here. So we are already on the upper part of like a viscously damped
right
collision.
Is it the same time scale to reach the settling velocity?
No.
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 No. It's shorter.
This should be like d over vs.
This is an observation. It's not I don't know what number that is. It's the amount of time it takes for the grain to stop from the moment it starts to deviate from its clear water settling velocity to the moment it's fully stopped moving. Mm. We'll increase the grain size and see what happens. But firstly, there's another grain here. Is it going? Yeah, and here we can see in the lateral velocity a lot clearer than in the previous example, that in these grain sizes of 1 millimeter, we have these typical fluctuating settlings. And the lateral velocities are typically an order of about 10% of the vertical velocity. And this is just in a 2D plane, right? It's my poor man's particle tracking. So I didn't do any stereo here to get the full 3D velocity out.
Just to be sure to be understand, what is the nature of the bottom?
It's a glass plate.
And it's a smooth glass plate?
Yeah, and that's also the reason why you can see the reflected grain after it has stopped. Yeah.
What is the width of the tank?
It's we are about this far away from the side of the tank, but it is 40 centimeters large behind it. So it's not it's not a constrained fall. It's quite an open fall. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why are we looking at this?
Because it's funny that is an oscillation.
I'll get to that point in the end. So if we go a little bit higher in the fall velocity, and this is a delayed view of it, and now we can actually see a bounce. So now we are in a larger Stokes number, and now we can actually see that the grain also has a negative vertical velocity. We can also see that it takes quite a while for the grain to stop moving in both the vertical velocity and the lateral velocities. So at these grain sizes of 2 millimeters in water and settling, we are getting bouncing and restitution coming in, which we didn't have at the smaller grain sizes. And if we go a little bit higher still to 3 millimeters.
So that's definitely an effect of the shape, because if it was a perfect sphere, it wouldn't bounce at all.
Yeah, it would bounce, yeah. At about a Stokes number of about 100, you start to get restitution and bouncing.
Even for the sphere.
So for a sphere, yeah.
And here you can get it earlier, or?
No, at the same moment, but restitution is something different here. If you have a sphere, then you have a normal restitution, but here you also have the rotational moment and also lateral restitution.
So even the smaller ones, the 1 millimeter particles, are not perfect spheres?
No, they're not. They're natural river sand.
Excuse me, I didn't get it. VS is the number again on
the vertical settling velocity.
Yes. So the Stokes number, you compute it a priori, you first measure the VS and then compute the Stokes number.
Yes.
So the Stokes number is an experimental
Stokes. Yes.
But what about the instability of the weight?
And the predicted fall velocity is just an expression from the Ferguson and Church paper for settling velocity outside the Stokes range for large grains, which gives a fairly good fit for these grains. And this one is nice. It's 4 millimeters, and now we can actually see. And what I did here, there are actually grains on that glass plate, but we can only see them to start move when the grain mobilizes them. So we need to go to 4 millimeters before we actually get the effect that the landing of the large grains is affecting the other grains on the bed. So one of the reasons I'm showing this is to illustrate that difference between the viscously affected landing or bouncing of grains when water is present versus what we've been seeing for the aeolian cases, where we see a bouncing and restitution and splashing at much, much smaller grain sizes because of the different viscous regime.
I mean, there has been work done on the Stokes number dependence of a coefficient of restitution.
Yes.
Okay.
So this is the last video before we get to that slide that has that on. It's a lot of repetitions in true scale, and what you can see here, which is quite nice, is firstly the grain jumps to the side enormously, so its restitution is not actually going up, it's going sideways because of the shape of the grain. And secondly, and I've looked at this a lot of times, and I think you can see it, is that what's actually remobilizing the grains that are also there is not the collision with the grain itself, but it's the jet of the wake following the grain that's actually impinging onto the bed. So in, when you talk about splash, and it's completely different type of splash. It's, there is something like that, but it's not the same thing as elastic collisions actually spraying up sand grains from the bed. So there is a big wake that travels behind this grain, and when the grain hits the bed, that wake itself actually jets onto the bed.
Grain which was under the stone.
No, it's I would say it's a combination of the two, but that is a good remark. Do you have any insights on this,
no,
perhaps from
the? There must be some fluid which has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
There's an added mass of fluid traveling with.
That's
the,
right.
Which mass is roughly half of that displaced water, which imparts additional momentum on the fluid.
Yeah.
In the case of air, the mass of that air, displaced air, is very small.
So how?
This, what you're saying, does not take into account the wake.
No, this is with wake or without wake.
Oh, with the wake, it can be different, no?
Added mass is just a potential concept. So it actually depends on it's half the displaced mass of fluid.
Kinetic energy.
In addition, there could be wake effect.
But the wake could be much more important than that in principle, because it can be much more mass that is moving into the wake after
the wake can diffuse.
What I was saying is
that there is some fluid mass which is associated with the, which has been accelerated around the fluid. And
but this is small compared to the particle mass.
It's half the volume.
Is it the water
less than one half, because the ratio is not one between the densities.
Yeah.
It's even less than a quarter or whatever.
Perhaps one can even speculate, I mean, the weight behind the particle at these large values of the Stokes number will essentially exist in the form of a vortex ring, and that vortex ring then impinges on the wall and spreads sideways, and that can set the other particles.
I think the type of experiments Ken Kiger presented last week or 2 weeks ago, where he actually did some PIV experiments seeding the fluid around things. If you do an experiment like that on this, you could actually give the final answer to this discussion.
It is a way of generating a vortex ring. It's not something we want to stop.
They just left.
Yeah.
I wondered about the oscillations you had in the transverse velocity, and the two experts here around me, they told me that it's due to the eddies in the wake. Is this true?
It's a periodic shedding of the wake away from the.
Okay.
Yeah.
They knew already.
And I actually, when another thing can. Kiger imprinted on me is this wind tunnel app that he, have you seen that? And it actually has a sand grain in it.
Yeah.
And if you, it's fixed, all right, but it's irregular and slightly oriented, and you can see periodic wake shedding coming of that really nicely.
So that's what you think. Yeah. The particle is turning is not so important, that it's tumbling.
I'm sure it's, but is it tumbling because of the asymmetric and periodic wake detachment?
Question is that connection. Now, if you have a particle falling, it's a three-dimensional environment. How does the vortex shedding work in that situation? Is it more or less in a plane, or is it kind of
circling around? In a sphere, the wave becomes unstable around the Reynolds number, which is twice as your Reynolds number definition based on diameter. At a Reynolds number around 180 or something, but since these particles are not perfectly spherical, it's lower, and that way even reasonably matches with what people have observed in spherical particles. But then when the Reynolds number hits around 300, you have other bifurcations, and you have a more complex
pattern. Mm-hmm. Rotation is possible, but not in the plane.
Because the body was not symmetric.
Well, it'll start to rotate from the edges, and maybe that helps lock it into a particular plane.
So this this plot is the summary figure of a bit of literature background research I did a few years ago to ask the question which viscous regimes these particles in water actually turbidity currents were in. So my geologist's axis is here, where it says silt, sand, granules, and pebbles. Those are my deposits. And what it turns out, if I put on the other axis in a different formulation, but that same Stokes number, and I translate how my sediments in my turbidity current are actually related to these bounces, where the maximum restitution is occurs from this Stokes number of 1,000 and upwards. So that's where the viscosity of the water becomes unimportant. So you have maximum elastic restitution. If you go beneath 1,000, you get partial bouncing. And we can see that all the examples that I was looking at in that little flume were in this this regime, because the resolution of the camera didn't allow me to image the smaller grains. But if we could, then we could actually see fully viscously damped collisions, where a particle seems to just drop dead on the floor, where it doesn't change its velocity, approach velocity at all. And if we go even smaller, so we go look at very fine grained sand or even silt, we get these kind of floating or decelerating landings onto the bed. So that is the kind of viscosity regime parameter range that is all present within a single turbidity current. And that struck me last week when I was listening to everybody, that this is why I want to know every time what size the particle is or what that Stokes number means, or because I know that all these things are somehow superimposed onto each other in a turbidity current. And I don't know.
Would this depend on the nature of the bonding surface?
I'm sure it does. Also, for the velocity here, I've used the settling velocity, and the problem becomes different if you have a flow velocity, of course. Yeah, so if you actually have a shear flow, then the velocity scale becomes different, and the effect of that would be that all these regimes move to smaller grain sizes. So if the velocity becomes higher with which they impact the bed due to the shear velocity, then the bouncing becomes more important. Yeah.
This is of course also always for just one particle, right?
Yes.
But many particles, yeah, can develop connective behavior,
yeah, and
which can really change things.
And what I was also thinking is that wake and the volume of that wake must be important, because if you have some large grains, you know that that wake has to be conserved. It has to go up as well, somewhere around it in the flow. And that wake velocity can become high enough to actually displace these smaller grains upwards. And that to me must be a very important mechanism that actually acts when you put all these grains together in a flow. But I have no testing or quantification of this. This is just a process concept that we have developed. Yeah.
So this slope seems to be like 1/3. Which indicates the volume of the displaced volume of the.
But what's this? Point?
What are the points on the curve?
The points on the curves are points on the curve. Yeah. But they don't actually mean anything. They are just the curve should have been plotted without any points on it as a curve.
And where do you get the curve from? What does it tell us?
The curve is the Stokes number for a given particle in stagnant water.
Yes. Okay. So it has something to do with the settling velocity or so? Or?
Yeah. Under gravity.
Yeah.
It's falling under
gravity. Yeah, and that's the reason why it's not a straight line, I feel.
Yeah. Yeah. You can translate it to the settling velocity or to the square of the settling? No, the settling
velocity. Yeah, but the settling velocity is way outside the Stokes range for those larger grains. So it's no longer, the settling velocity doesn't increase with the square of the grain size there anymore, but much slower.
Is it essentially the same thing that Dietrich reported for large particles?
Yeah, it is essentially a variation of the Dietrich curve that has been used to calculate the settling velocity.
That doesn't help me because I don't know what the Dietrich curve is.
Okay, Dietrich in 1982 published an approximation for the settling of grains under both the Stokes regime as under the much larger than where you have the turbulent drag into the. And there are a number of others. The one I prefer to use is Ferguson and Church because it's really easy to use for with a modification for the shape of the grain, empiric modification for the grain shape.
But this is a regime map, isn't it, versus Stokes number?
Yes.
With, let's say, the additional information of particle size.
That's right.
In given circumstances.
Yes. And the circumstances here are clear water without any velocity, and velocity is coming from the gravity settling. It's nothing more than that. So
can I ask you a question? Okay, so what would you say about the splash function of a particle underwater?
I don't know, but you ask me why are we looking at this? Well, it's precisely to make that point. It must be something else, but yeah. I mean, what it is, I don't know. But it has to be take into account the viscous forces of the pore fluid as the grain approaches the bed as well, and also the hydrodynamic effect of the wake or the added mass, if you want.
Or could we just simply say, well, splash is not important underwater?
Well, it is for large grain sizes, for a different set of grain, and for those grain sizes, it does remobilize sand grains from the bed, which is incredibly hard thing to do.
This is important for alien transport as well. If you've got particles that are too small to get out of the viscous sublayer,
yeah,
but they only get mobilized by big impact.
But this what interests me about this is we say okay, so ripples or bed forms are we have ripples underwater and we have ripples under air, and how are we going to compare the grain scales? And I'm like, yeah, but phenomenologically the process of entrainment is a completely different thing. So does that mean that we should just say, let there be entrainment with splash or viscous impingement or whatever, and then we can start to form these bed forms? Or do we actually need to incorporate what the precise phenomenon of the interaction is? Because if the latter is true, then ripples in the water and ripples in the air are not the same thing.
But that's what we would say anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
We would say the ripples underwater are more like humans.
Okay, but the same holds for using the term saltation, for instance.
Yes.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, in sand transport in water, and you know, at least in coastal, where we do not worry too much about this large grain, mostly just sand, and we always assume uniform. We rarely talk about saltation or splash function because based on what you showed,
because
there,
it doesn't exist there. Yeah.
The reason is that in the case of water, the density difference is only 2.5.
No, the viscosity.
And the velocities are comparable. I mean,
yeah, but the difference for me is the viscosity between the air and the water. That to me is the real difference.
But I think that the momentum of the particle coming and impacting, I mean, you have turbulent processes bringing the same amount of, or if not more, and more widespread, so they cause even more resuspension of particles. Whereas in the air, each particle collision has a lot of momentum and energy carried by the particle. Air doesn't carry that much.
Well, if you then say a lot of momentum with respect to the velocity and then viscosity, sorry, then we have that Stokes number on that axis, and then you have that could be tested by putting the viscosity of air and normal velocities of grains in Aeolian transport in that comparison. I mean, it's testable, I would say.
This gets affected. I just want to play at the few, short distances before impact, but really what's the inertia?
Well, but okay, so that's a fluid perspective, minus, as I've illustrated, a geologist perspective. That's where the deposit is formed. And that's what my question is. What are the phenomena that are forming this deposit? And you're saying, yeah, but it only acts when that grain is just like near the boundary. Right? Yeah, but that's gonna determine what the characteristics of my, that's where my research question is. What is this deposit? How was it formed? And how are its characteristics spatially related to the types of flows that go on into the ocean? That's where my focus is.
Maybe I can just give a gentle reminder that we should pay a little bit of attention to the time. I have the impression that you still have a lot more that you want to get through.
Yeah, I did not think that these first 20 slides would take me an hour.
But 20 slides always take about an hour, don't they?
Yeah, yeah, I can do a 15-minute conference presentation and win a prize with that, with 20 slides.
We're not going to get punished because there won't be any cookies left by the time. Oh. Coffee break.
So these were my the discussions that I wanted to raise, and we have done so. So I can have a bit of a relaxation by having some rocks again. So this is Steve. This is Steve Hubbard at one of the field sites that he's done a lot of research at in southern Patagonia in the last austral summer. So this is how you dress up in summer in field work in Patagonia. And this is really great. This is actually a channel deposit, so a turbidity current channel deposit, sandstones and shales deposited in a channel. And the work they have done is on reconstructing the shape and characteristic distributions of those deposits. And that is what we call the channel fill in cross-section. And we see that the channel fill becomes thinner and broader as it goes upwards. And that's like a systematic signature. And where we come in with our experiments is to try to understand which kind of processes in the turbidity current system could have that morphological evolution. And as true field geologist, Steve has sat down on the most interesting part of the outcrop, but it wasn't blocked entirely. So I have put my bag right in front of it there as well. But we can always go back to Patagonia and take another picture. But what's happening there on the left is actually one of these. We are sitting precisely here on one of these locations where a thick sandstone really rapidly thins onto what was once the channel margin. So we want to understand what this tells us about which grains were in suspension in the vertical profile in the current. So what we want to do is do experiments with morphological evolutions in three dimensions. And this has been tried before a lot of times. Philip Kühnen, 1951, is enormously impressive experimental publication starting in 1926, doing all the seminal work on processes of turbidity currents. And if you look at the literature, then after him, nobody really developed this morphology. So what we typically see, nice example is a scour hole. The turbidity current has come into the flume here. This is actually a numerical simulation of some experiments they did. And it spreads out and it deposits this kind of arcuate shape around it. And that's all that happens. And people have sometimes said if you would run turbidity currents long enough over this, then what would actually happen is that would extend into a channel. But it doesn't. So this is not an incipient channel, no matter how long you run those currents. And it was quite nicely illustrated by Roland et al. In 2010, and I entirely agree with their with their arguments. So they say if you have a typical cross-section of a channel structure on the seafloor with levees next to it, and it has a pathway that predominantly passes the current by, then that is not the type of structure that we are simulating with an experiment like this. And this is a thickness of the deposit and the center of gravity of the deposit in a flume experiment. That is not a channel, and it will never really evolve into one. That's what they say, and I agree with them. Which is not to say that it's not an analog in terms of landscape to what we see in nature. So this is a plate tectonic image, oceanographic image from northern California. This really big fault zone here actually turns around and is the beginning of the San Andreas fault zone. And this oceanic plate is continuously going beneath the margin there. And the color coding is water depth. So this blue is about 3,000, and this is just a few hundred meters. And we have a very steep, very high slope in between, with a gradient of about 1 in 20. So that's very steep. And it's related to this continental subduction under the margin in California. And if we zoom in on the next image is the view with this red arrow focusing on this turbidity current canyon, and especially what happens at the bottom here. And we see that at the bottom of that very steep incised canyon, there is a plunge pool where the turbidity currents come down onto the flat ocean basin. There's a scour, and beyond that scour, there's no driving force for the turbidity current anymore. It's been completely shut off like that, and it just depletes all its sediment. And that's the type of setting when you get these architectures that everybody has been building in the experimental turbidity currents.
Just to understand what you said that the turbidity current has been depleted by of sediment in the plunge pool.
After the plunge pool.
So it basically scours out to a certain.
It does. But it needn't even, it could also be that it just doesn't deposit there. So you end up with a pool, but because you have sedimented a ring around it and you haven't sedimented anything in the pool. So that's the plunge pool. It needn't be erosive. It can be, but it doesn't really change the picture much. But it's certainly not an analog to these types of conceptual settings, which are the accepted morphologies and deposit to landscape relationships for turbidity current systems. But that is a very poor analog.
Let's say in some of these contexts, when you say turbidity current, don't you mean underwater avalanche?
Okay, when I say turbidity current, I mean particulate gravity driven current. And if you want to call that an underwater avalanche, then I'm entirely okay.
There's no assumption of diluteness that you're making.
No. Well, I don't need to make that. I hear people doing it, but the reason why I don't do it is because it may be true for the majority of the vertical profile, but right where the deposit is formed near the bed, I have absolutely no need for that assumption that the concentration is low. Far from that, actually. I don't think that that's valid.
Well, I'd be more comfortable if we reserved turbidity for the dilute part of the flow and talked about perhaps the dense part of the flow separately.
There is.
It's just that there are different physics involved in the two.
Yeah, that was the next part of my talk, but we're not going to make it today. That's a very good point. But I would not. I agree with you on the physics, but I have no need to put in the semantics of drawing in a boundary and calling it a different name. To me, that whole vertical structure, which has gradients of density towards the base, just happens in one and the same current, and I. could even show you in 10 slides time that there is fluctuating structure behavior from the one to the other within one current if you try to keep the concentration constant.
If you can go back one slide, I was also wondering, you can see at the mouth of the channel that it seems like whenever there's a current coming out, it seems to be turning to its right.
Yeah.
You think that's a manifestation of Coriolis forces effect?
Well, tempting, but what about the sinuosity of the canyon, right? The history of the flow as it comes out is important. Does the last bend happen to go in the other direction so that the current is actually going to do that anyway? I'm sure there is an important Coriolis effect on these things, and it's possible, but we would need the exact same canyon to come in a mirrored margin and then for it to also turn right to be sure. Yeah.
Is this a natural stopping point? Because we could continue, schedule a continuation?
Well, yeah, I really tried to do the 1 hour, 30 minutes, but this is literally the half my talk done there. But everything's a natural stopping point in my presentation.
I suggest that we try to reschedule part two.
Yeah, we were going to try not to do that.
We're finished with part two.
Okay.
Now what we reschedule a little focused discussion.
Okay, very good.
In which you can raise other pieces of your talk, it seems to me that, I said, focus. Otherwise, we're going to get involved in another 90-minute talk.
Yeah, no, I agree. But I have to say that I tried to write this talk this way, but a lot of the questions were, in a normal conference, everybody would have just let me talk. No, but this is true. And then a lot of the points, everybody was discussing precisely the points I was trying to poke you to discuss.
It's a successful talk. It's brilliant.
Yeah, but it's not. But what you are describing did not work, because then I would have given all of my presentation and we would have split out to those discussions. And this is only...
I think that's a good point, yeah.
It didn't work this time.
So I'm suggesting that you give your entire talk in two different ways.
Well, one with the audience being silent and then breaking out the discussion groups. No, but I don't see a good solution to this.
Well, I think it's something we have to decide.
But it was very, for me, it was interesting, but we did not cover the subject matters that I wanted to, but I really enjoyed that discussion. But if we're going to do it like this every time, then forget about that setup that you are mentioning, because we're not going to cover the subject matter.
What about going on for half an hour?
No, we
have to stop. Cookie talk. This is a rule.
It's a
KITP rule.
Some things are sacred.
So we have a break now anyway.
No, I think we should stop for coffee and cookies.
The question is, do we want to resume it for?
I know, we can decide on that over coffee and
cookies.
Okay.
Good idea.